You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to day two of the Municipal Finance Conference here at Brookings. Thank you to our Brookings hosts and all who worked hard to put this on. This is breakout session two, track one. Let's check if you're in the right place, on the right plane. I struggled a little bit with the topic for this panel, the name of the panel. And I worked on it a little bit last night, and I think I came up with something here I just wanted to share. So this panel is the privatization of municipal debt, its impact on climate change through the pricing of U.S. green bonds, and the resulting correlation to newspaper closures on public finance. I think it has a ring to it. Let it grow on you. But our first speaker, as it relates to that first third of that title, speaking on the privatization of municipal debt, is Ivan Ivanov, who is here from the Federal Reserve. He's a senior economist in the stress testing area. Prior to joining the Federal Reserve, Ivan was a financial economist at the U.S. SEC from 2012 to 2014. Ivan's research examines questions in financial regulation, financial intermediation, banking, corporate finance, and public finance. His most recent work in financial regulation studies the design of bank supervision programs, demonstrates the causal impact of supervision on bank lending, and highlights the benefits of continued disclosure to bank supervisors, for which the banks are eternally grateful, I'm sure. Ivan's recent research in financial intermediation has focused on understanding how bank credit helps companies manage liquidity shocks. His research has been cited in the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, and the Harvard Law School Forum on Corporate Governance and Financial Regulation. Ivan earned his PhD in finance from the William E. Simon Graduate School of Business at the University of Rochester in 2012. Ivan, thank you for your paper. Come on up.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me. I'll just make sure to stand close to the microphone. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the privatization of municipal debt, and this is joint work with Tom Zimmerman. First I wanted to say that these are our own views and not the views of the Fed or the Federal Reserve System. So what's this paper all about? After the financial crisis, we've seen the financial position of a lot of state and local governments weaken, the most commonly cited explanations for that has been like rising pension obligations, rising healthcare costs, higher than ever, or like record high unmet infrastructure investments. At the same time, state and local governments have increased their reliance on bank loans. And here on this graph, you can actually see this trend. So the black line would show you the bank loans. So the black line shows you the bank loans, and basically this is the right axis here, and then the gray line shows you bonds. That is the left axis, and as you can see on this chart, loans have increased substantially since 2006, from almost $30 billion to more than $170 billion, and for bonds we've had no change since 2010. The goal of this paper is to shed some light on this trend, this has been very difficult because there is no information on the muni bank loans, right? So we only have information on the bonds. And I think the major reason for this is SEC doesn't have a formal requirement to for the state and local governments to show their bank debt. So I think they're working on a rule right now, but as of this point, you have no formal requirement. So what we do in this paper is we basically look at loan data for the state and local governments,
and we studied the muni bank debt market. So just to give you a brief brief highlight of the results of what we find. So the first goal of the paper is just to show you how these bank loans look like. So the first thing that stands out is that bank loans have like higher contractual seniority. So they have high priority, they're secured, they have the highest security, they have short maturities, and sometimes includes even like additional like contractual guarantees. So the story that stands out from these summary stats is mainly that the muni entities that are not that are in poor like financial health, they have to somehow open up debt capacity. And like one way to do this is to like include new lenders that would have like higher seniority as compared to the bonds. Okay, so the second part of the paper we show that a lot of these entities have substantial risk, and then in the last part of the paper we ask like whether this trend towards increased reliance on bank loans is likely to keep going. And what we do there is we see how these muni entities respond to income shocks. So we find that basically adverse income shocks lead to higher reliance on bank debt. This comes from both like long-term shocks and short-term shocks. Then we conclude the paper. Where do these data come from? So we use two sources. The major source we use in the paper is the data from the Fed, the Y14 data, that would give us unique opportunity to look at muni bank loans. So these data starts in 2012 Q3 and includes like all loans above one million in commitment size. So you can see very, very, very rich information on these loans. You can see whether these loans are lines of credit, term loans, other types of loans. You can also like see whether they're senior, like their maturity, their rate, like everything about the loan. The bonds are coming from the standard data source that you get muni bond issuance, emergent. And from there, we get both like geo bonds and revenue bonds. So let me give you just a brief highlight of the bank loan data that we have. This chart here, red line shows you utilized funded exposure, and then the black line shows you the total committed exposure. So like the total committed exposure is larger because you could have lines of credit that are not used. So what you can see here that basically, if you compare to the graph that I showed you before, like we pick up approximately 60% of all muni bank lending, and the reason we don't pick up all is because we don't see small banks, right? Like the banks that we have in the sample are just the large banks in the States. Okay, so but the rich aspect of these data is that we not only see the red line, which you can get from the call reports at a very high level, but we also pick up the total commitment of the debt. Okay, so sorry for putting too many numbers on this slide. Here, like in this table, we've shown like how the bank loans like of states, counties, cities, districts look like. The main thing that like stands out from this table is that in terms of like the type of loan, like most of the debt to like muni entities is in terms of term loans. So this is approximately like 58% of all loans to counties, 54% to cities, and like 51% districts.
for like states, you have a mixture between lines of credit and term loans. And then to a lesser extent, for all these types of entities, you have also other types of debt leases and other types that I haven't shown here. So
another thing that is important to note here is that for the lines of credit, the size of the lines of credit are substantially larger than the part that has been used. So you can see
for states, this is approximately $36 million. Basically, is the size of the line, and then only like six mil has been drawn.
You see the same pattern basically for the other types of entities. So the sample size here is large because the states could issue like these bank loans through several types of entities that they have, like say the local state libraries or the basically state like healthcare unit, and so there's many different units that could issue those, but those units are affiliated with, say, the state or the county or the city government. Okay, so here I'm showing you two pictures for both lines of credit and term loans. What like stands out from this picture is that most of the debt of these entities is in terms of highly secured debt. The vast majority has first lien, and then whenever the debt is not secured, it is senior in terms of like contractual priority. Now, in terms of like riskiness, we see that these entities that obtain bank loans, they're substantially riskier than the entities that would have a bond rating. So approximately 18, 16, and 22% of state, county, city, and district like governments have like ratings of BB and lower. And the BB ratings have approximately 1% chance of default within the next year. The single B have approximately 4, and then like if you're rated lower, it's substantially higher probability of default. The loss given default that the banks like assign is also like not small. So in the next part of the paper, like we're just looking at how the reliance of bank debt would vary like across county characteristics. So in this part of the of our work, we are only looking at the U.S. counties, and the main reason for this is that the census data for this part of like unit structure is more readily available. So we look at three main characteristics here, like household income, population, and the total debt to income of the county, and then according to all three, you can see that lower income, less populated, less levered counties tend to have higher like reliance on bank debt. This analysis is highly suggestive. So what we do next is we look at how the counties respond to income shocks. And we look at two types of income shocks. Like one of them is a longer type, like longer term income shock, and the other one is a shorter term income shock. So permanent income shocks. Like we adopt the methodology of Suarez, Serrato, and Wingender. The type of income shock they use is based on the census counts. So every 10 years, the census does an actual count. What the shock like here is the gap between the actual census count and the forecast. You would say that this type of gap could be related to economic growth and to all these type of other characteristics. But I think it's important to note here that The gap comes from not only from the forecast. The gap comes from the errors in actual count that the census does, right? So this paper shows that the shock, it doesn't seem to be related to economic growth. Like, they do a host of tests to show that there is no anticipation of local governments, state and local governments. And to arrive at the gap, like, since every 10 years, the census only would show you the actual count rather than the forecast, we use this type of a regression to figure out what the forecast would have been if the census did it, using the prior nine years of like data that the census has on their website. And this is how we basically arrive at the gap. And just to show you how large the gap could be between the actual count and the forecast, in approximately 10% of the time, we have like really large differences. So I don't show it here, but we find that these differences do not seem to be spatially correlated or like related to economic growth. Okay, so the response to like income shocks, what we do here is we basically look at several types of outcomes, and the bank lending at the county government, and also we look at bond financing, and we have two types of shocks. We basically split the shock into positive and like adverse component, and we also account for the muni size, firm productivity, and income controls. And also include like stated time quarter like fixed effects. And so like what we find here is basically that the bank finance would go up after the shock. And so this is part A. And then like figure B shows you that there is not a significant effect for bonds. And as a result, what we find is that the debt share is higher after these shocks. Now, just to conclude, I'm going to skip the second type of shock because we don't have time. So what we show overall in this paper is that the trend towards increased reliance on bank loans is likely to persist as more muni entities face like weaker financial position. And so like what we do more of in the paper is like we actually discuss how this could this type of increasing debt priority could make it more difficult for these muni entities to raise debt going forward. And our paper also shows that the claimed dilution problem may be a relevant consideration for the bondholders who are already there. And then absence of a disclosure requirement like now may lead to higher cost of bond funding for the state and local governments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ivan. Discussing Ivan's paper is longtime friend of the conference, Colin McNaught, who is co-founder and CEO of BondLink. Colin has more than 15 years of experience in the municipal bond market. Prior to BondLink, Colin managed the Commonwealth of Massachusetts borrowing needs from 2008 to 2015 and did a great job keeping them in debt. Thank you, Colin. Over that time, he issued close to $25 billion in bonds and notes. His work was distinguished for its innovation and was awarded several awards from groups like the NFMA and SIFMA, as well as two National Deal of the Year awards from the bond buyer. A big focus of his time was on boosting the state's transparency to investors. Colin studied public finance at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Colin, thank you.
thanks, Peter, and thanks to Dan and David and Rich for including me. As Peter mentioned, I was on the issuer side for a long time, and I was there at the beginning. And Muniland is full of conferences. I attend them all, for good or for bad. This is the most interesting. And I think this one has the most opportunity to actually help issuers. So let me get into why I think this paper is important and try to set a little bit of a backdrop here. So from my perspective, and this started a few years ago while I was still at the Commonwealth of Mass, there was a new dynamic in the market. I thought it was really important that issuers recognize that the rules of the game are starting to change. And disclosure is becoming super, super important. And you see that investors are demanding more, and you see that regulators are demanding more. You know, the seminal report from the SEC from 2012 really calling out that there could be, you know, sort of a subclass of investors in Muniland, the way they're treated from a disclosure perspective. Institutional investors are being asked to do more with less. Less reliance on bond insurance, less reliance on S&P and Moody's. They're doing more work internally, and a lot of big funds are moving towards algorithmic trading. So that means getting rid of humans. And then for the issuers, the fragility of the buyer base. Post-tax reform, we've seen big buyers step away from the market. That might be temporary, that might be permanent, but there's also an expectation for higher rates. Now, we've all been thinking that for the last 5 years. It could continue for another five, but that risk is definitely out there in terms of new dynamics for issuers. So in general, from everything I've heard from investors over the last 10 or 15 years, disclosure in Muniland is really hard for three reasons. One, it's really hard to find data. Two, when you find it, it's really stale. And three, when you finally find that data and it's really stale data, it's really hard to compare apples to apples. DC should be very easy to compare to Los Angeles, to Chicago, to Boston. It's not for a whole host of reasons. Not anything to do with issuers, but those are major obstacles for investors. And then the sort of the makeup of the market, 50,000 different issuers, a million bonds outstanding, it's really, really difficult. So these are my rules of thumb here. Where you're going as an issuer is much more important than where you've been. So your interim data, getting that information out, is much more important from an issuer. What happens in between bond sales, which is what Ivan and Tom's paper was getting at. Let investors decide what's important. So it's really not up to bond counsel or for you as the issuer, but get it all out. Get it all out. Get the good news out fast, get the bad news out faster. I think that's what we're supposed to do on the issuer side. So I think the timeliness of Ivan and Tom's paper is spot on. Bank loans have absolutely exploded. There's not a lot of good data on what's out there in terms of the volume, the pace, or what's in these documents. So the MSRB is really, really focused on this over the last couple of years and been very, very active because they have big concerns. These are not direct loans are not securities. So they don't fall under the traditional 15C212 requirements. There's no requirements to post these documents. You know, despite a relatively attractive environment for any type of credit to issue bonds, even lower-rated counties, for some reason these products have exploded onto the scene. And when I was still in the issuer side, I was pitched on direct loans. And the idea was these are much more efficient than issuing bonds. It's one investor. It's one quick negotiation. There may or may not be a CUSIP. There may or may not be a rating. No disclosure requirements. Very, very easy and fast capital. And you know what Ivan and Tom were looking at is big issuers versus small issuers. So the focus as well in their paper on competing claims, from my perspective, wasn't really an issue 10 years ago. It is now. Through bankruptcies and high-profile bankruptcies and defaults. You have Detroit, you had Puerto Rico, and a whole host of others. Trying to decide who gets first claim. And the whole issue around smaller issuers versus larger issuers. You know, Mark Jaffe put out a paper a few years ago about the fees associated with raising capital, and the fees are significantly higher for smaller issuers. So in Tom and Ivan's paper, they really focused on the decisions being made at these smaller organizations, smaller counties, that, who tend to be poorer. And if their analysis is true, it's not a good sign. You know, from my perspective, all issuers should take a long-term view of the market. So to experience a credit shock, and I'll get into that next, and then to decide on the most expedient form of capital, which could include provisions that are going to hurt the county over the long term, is a major obstacle that the whole market should see as a big concern. And the market really suffered 15 years ago, 20 years ago, when interest rate swaps became a major problem. That was a whole host of bad headlines for the market. It definitely impacted investor participation and raised credit concerns. And this smells the same, this direct loan issue, if the data is correct. So the major assumption here is that all of these agreements include senior claims. And, you know, I just know from what I've seen, and that was a few years ago, that they didn't, that they weren't all uniform. And there were not uniform acceleration provisions. Obviously, if you're a bondholder at a big fund or a big insurance company or even mom and pop, you don't want the issuer to enter into an agreement where there's a senior claim or acceleration. You know, the whole idea behind disclosure is not just documents and data, it's trust. So, you know, if you're a institutional investor or retail and you're lending money for 20 years or 30 years to a large county or a small county, and then they turn around and enter into a side agreement with a bank with acceleration provisions and a senior claim, and that is also not disclosed, so you don't find out about it until you see the next audit, which could be 9 months from now, that's a major problem. But that is a big assumption that these agreements have senior claims. I will defer to the experts on whether that data can be picked up from the Federal Reserve filings. The economic shocks, the long and the transitory, I think they're excellent tests of the theory. I really like the census test, the way that the census makes an adjustment, the way that it's rolled in over the course of a few years, and then the county adjusting to that shock over the next few years. The second, the transitory, I understand why you'd want to test the transitory. Being from Boston, where we are shocked by snowstorms several times a year, I'm not sure that is the right test. You know, just anecdotally, my understanding of county government, counties from an income perspective are much more reliant on property taxes as opposed to a sales tax or an income tax. So to me, looking at the effect of a snowstorm, I don't know that there'd be a major credit event for a county which would require them to totally change the way that they raise capital for the bridge project, so to speak. So again, I would look, if, you know, this is still in draft form, if you were taking another run at looking at the effects of a shock, maybe looking at the prices, home prices, which is something that Christine Cuny looked at last year in her paper on disclosure. So changes in local prices are observable and correlated, and it's the largest own source of revenue for most local governments. So my recommendation, I think the paper is spot on. There's a big if there that all of these agreements have senior claims relative to public bondholders. If that is true, that should be a major concern. My suggestion for the researchers is to take another stab at the second test and use a different test to tease out whether this is actually impacting smaller and less affluent counties. And that's it.
Great. Thank you both. And we are now going to start the Q&A portion of the discussion. Maybe first, give an opportunity, Ivan, if you wanted to share any thoughts on the discussion that Colin provided.
I just wanted to say these were awesome points. Thank you so much. So the first point that you raised, that we may have to do more to look at how the bank loans might be senior, more or less senior than the bonds. This is something that we're working on, but this would have would actually require us to match the sub entities within the state or the county. And so that's all the work, but we're going to have this in the next draft, because this is the key. Basically, we have to show that the bank loans are more senior than the bonds. At this point, this seems likely, because bank loans seem to be substantially shorter term, as well. So even in time, even if you look at how bonds and bank loans are paid over time. If you have bonds already and then you have a new very short-term loan, then I think this would give a higher seniority to the loan. So this is a very good point. The second point about the shock, the major reason we used snowstorms is because we wanted to see how these entities respond to short-term shocks as well. And I think the surprising result that we find there is that the munis, they tend to increase bank debt even though the shock is supposed to be very short term. And so we find that at the end of the year, even though the snowstorm occurs in Q1 of every year, we find that at the end of the year you still have some outstanding draw under the lines of credit. So that's what the point of the shock was. Thank you, though.
Great. So we'll open it up to questions. I would say let's just keep the questions away from election meddling. Okay, great. Yeah.
Rich Rifle, watch you. So I'm wondering, in light of Andy's paper yesterday about the impact of advanced refundings, and it's likely that we're going to see the data shows that after tax reform we have less bank placements. So moving forward, less likely the bank market will be active. Do you think the role of banks will increase rushing in to do some of the things that, Andy suggested might happen in the public markets, but that are difficult to do? So, short calls, more par coupons, notwithstanding the fact that banks are generally issuing or buying short pieces of paper, I could see banks being a much better, more efficient way to fund munis moving forward, even though it's not as financially advantageous for them now. So, that's directed to both you and Colin. So.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Here? Okay, that's a very good point. If you look at the chart I had on the second slide or the third slide, it seems like the bank loans have gone down a little bit from the trend in Q1 of 2018, but this drop is not very large. So based on the chart, it seems like that this trend is going to persist. Also, if you look at my sensor shocks, you would see how one of the major factors there would be how well they're doing financially. So if you have a lot of these entities that are not doing so well, then you might have them being more likely to issue bank loans. But based on what I have, it's really tough to say how this is going to keep going.
Yeah, I agree, Rich. I'm not smart enough to give you a smart answer to that question. I think products should really come from the issuer side. And 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, rates are at 2.5%, 3%. And I'm on the issuer side being pitched these bank loans. Capital's been very, very easy. And I'm sure there are going to be products that are developed to respond to demand for additional refunding. but how those products are structured should really come from the issuer side. And I think what the MSRB has done in terms of highlighting the potential risk of these bank loans has been really, really important. You know, we can argue about the form of that relief or that disclosure, but the fact that the regulator highlighted it with the work of the SEC, I think, is really, really important. So we're not going back down the path of a lot of small issuers entering into agreements that they probably shouldn't have, like you saw with interest rate swaps 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yes, Steve.
This is for Colin. I know at the Commonwealth you did.
And you are?
Oh, I'm sorry. Steve Winterstein, Woolmates Trust. I know you spent a lot of time at the Commonwealth on transparency. I loved your quote, get good news out fast, get bad news out faster. That's a good adage to live by, I think, if you're an issuer. And you're doing God's work now with your new company, BondLink. But what I'm really interested in knowing, sorry for the shameless plug, but what I'm really interested in knowing, Colin, as you talk to these issuers and you spend a lot of time meeting those who make these decisions, do you think that they understand the importance of disclosure when it comes to bank loans? And are they empathetic and even sympathetic to bondholders that were placed in this awkward position of not knowing, and that they really, it's their job to get that information out? What's your sense of a trend?
Yeah, thanks for that question. And I'm going to share my parents that someone said I'm doing God's work. And I'll share that with my wife because I'm on the road so much. They will all appreciate that. Yes and no. I think capital is very easy to raise in this market. And I just think on the issuer side, you never want to have that attitude that it's, you just walk up to the water spigot and turn the spigot and the money flows. On the issuer side, I try to put myself in the shoes of an investor. We're asking for several $100 million to build the bridge. We're transferring interest rate risk to that investor. Oh, by the way, we're not going to repay you for 20 or 30 years. So it's a big ask. And I thought part of that agreement was to share information with investors. I think in general, a lot of issuers spend 100% of their time focusing on the rating agencies. And that is very important. It's obviously a very visible thing. And it goes way beyond how you price. It also is something that the mayor and the county administrator look at as well. But spending 100% of your time with the rating agencies and 0% of your time with investors, I think, is a major missed opportunity. I don't know what the allocation of resources and time is, but it can't be 100% and 0%. As you know, Steve, the rating is something that an investor might look at, but you're doing your own internal assessment. I actually thought one of Ivan's slides was really interesting, showing the internal ratings of banks. And one of the footnotes said that 18% of banks have states rated below investment grade. That's 9 states. That's really interesting. So shops like yours, I'm sure, Steve, you're doing your own credit work. So I think it's really critical for issuers to also go to the investor side and ask investors, what do you want? Do you want a 5% coupon, a 3% coupon? Do you like direct loans? Should I be disclosing these? I think it's a conversation that you need to have with your lender.
Yes, Dan.
What is the Dan Bergstresser, Brandeis? What is the penetration of financial advice? Issuers that are borrowing through bank loans, are they typically doing this hand in hand with a financial advisor? And the same would go for people who are doing P3s that embed borrowing. Are they typically doing these types of things with advice from a financial advisor, or are they doing it unadvised?
We have an advisor. I can
take a stab at that as an advisor. I think that's probably correlated in some ways to the size of the issuer, but I think for the most part now, issuers are using advisors. When you're looking at P3 deals, which are actually fairly few given the amount of talk about them, Those definitely have one, if not multiple advisors on those. But I think with bank loans as well, it's rare now that an advisor is so distant from an issuer that that they're not around somewhere. That's a good question, though. Yes. No.
Hi, I'm Adele Morris. I'm an economist here at Brookings, and I work on climate and energy policy. So this isn't my field, but I'm very interested in what you found about the increase in bank loans. You mentioned that a lot of these loans are collateralized, and I'm interested in what kind of collateral exactly we're talking about, and were the loans to default, how easy or hard is it to actually collect on that collateral? A separate question is, I'm curious about whether there are different political rules or policy rules about issuing debt versus taking on a bank loan in jurisdictions, for example, where you have to vote on a bond issue but perhaps not vote on an equivalent bank loan. I'm curious about that.
That's a good point. I would need to look into that. My data could allow me to see what type of assets secure the loan, but I haven't done so yet. That's a very good point. And I think it would help us to figure out whether these are looking like more like geo bonds or whether they look more like revenue bonds. So we'll do this in the next draft of the paper. Now, for the rules, in terms of like whether these entities could issue, this is difficult. I think this is difficult to gauge because I know for a fact that different jurisdictions have different rules, and it would be very, very difficult to have like set of data on like how these rules work because there's like so many aspects, but we could look into that and see where we get where there might be an easy way for us to like split the entities into several groups or something. Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you.
There are statutory debt requirements in terms of what's necessary to provide for the issuance of debt or taking on debt. And in many cases, statutory debt limits. But whether or not those would apply to a bank loan would depend upon how that legislation was written. And as Ivan said, that will vary often from state to state or entity to entity. Yes, red.
Linda Mankowski, Stern Brothers. So given that you're pulling data from the Federal Reserve, would your data set allow you to look at the cost of funding for the bank for the loan versus an equivalent commercial loan and what that differential means to them? Would you be able to pull that data so that you could gauge whether the bank is actually making an on-market commercial loan equivalent when they're going into the municipal space? Because in those instances, they're tax exempt, so they're tax advantaged back up to the bank. I was just curious whether or not there's profitability for the bank to actually be doing the municipal bank loan.
So we could not observe that, but we can observe whether the issue is tax exempt. And if you go to, this is not something I've shown here, but if you go to my paper, you could see that I have like a statistic on that. And I think it's approximately 50%, I'm not quite sure, but 50% of them are exempt, tax exempt. And I think here the same rules would apply. If the issue, if the bank absorbs the entire issue and then the issue is up to 10 mil, I think that's the rule right now, then it could be tax exempt. If it's larger, then it's not. But I could see that and I could do more work on this. I just worry a little bit. It's outside of the scope of this specific paper, and maybe this is something else I could do on the side. But yeah, I could see like the tax exception. It would have been very nice to observe the cost of like funding, but I don't see that. Thank you, though.
One last quick question.
was trying, Marianne Edmonds, Public Resources Advisory Group, just a few practical observations from a practitioner. For a financial advisor or municipal advisor now to do a bank loan is pretty common, but it's also pretty common to be terrified that the SEC is going to come in and decide that that bank loan was really a security, mm-hmm. and hence you are an unlicensed, unregistered broker-dealer, and the wrath of the SEC is going to come to bear. So there are some real... We do bank loans. Financial advisors have to be very careful about the documentation of bank loans, because otherwise they're in violation of communicating and working directly with investors. So there are a lot of practical implications like that that impact this market and bank loans versus securities.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks to the panelists. I'm wondering, one last note, Dan Bergstrasser and I did a little research on this before, and there have been MSRB guidelines related to best practices when it comes to disclosing bank loan information. A lot of that data, unfortunately, is in PDFs that are uploaded to the MSRB site. They have threatened a classification of information that they would ultimately put together on bank loans that have come up. The last time I checked, that hadn't happened yet. But it'd be interesting to take the Federal Reserve data and ultimately compare it to some of that data. There's optical character recognition stuff that could go through those PDFs.
So that's the first thing I did, actually, when I started to work on this. And then from the 50,000 state and local governments, only 75 of those had put information there. And among those 75 long contracts, I think the information...
75 out of 50,000?
Yeah, 75. And then among those, I think the information on interest rates, maturities was just blackened out. So you couldn't see anything.
It's a redacted world we live in.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you both. All right.
Thank you.
All right, great. Part two of three, we have Jeff Wergler, who's here and is going to address and present a paper that he has worked on, Financing the Response to Climate Change, the Pricing and Ownership of U.S. Green Bonds. Jeff is the Nomura Professor of Finance at NYU Stern School of Business. His research and teaching interests include corporate finance and behavioral finance. Before joining Stern in 2001, Professor Wergler was the Robert B. and Candace J. Haas Assistant Professor of Corporate Finance at Yale School of Management. He has also been a visiting professor at the University of Oxford, Said Business School. Professor Wergler received a Bachelor of Arts and Sciences degree from Stanford and a PhD in Business Economics from Harvard University. While at Stanford, although it's not as in bio, he apparently was on a football team that thrashed Dan Bergstrasser's team. He's humble about that. Dan is still stinging, but somehow they managed to come together and work on this research together. So I just wanted to note the hurdles that people go through to get research here, and we really applaud them overcoming some of those personal hurdles. That's right. Very civilly, they've come together here for this research. All right. Welcome, Jeff.
So this is a paper with Malcolm Baker, the ubiquitous Dan Bergstrasser, and George Serafine from HBS. It's fair to say that with respect to climate change, there is no good news. 16 of the last 17 years are the warmest since worldwide record-keeping began, or data are available. I just checked, it's 103 degrees, the high temperature today in your hometown, Dan, and it's 107 later this week. So this sort of extraordinary weather event, which is increasingly less extraordinary in the case of Dallas or many other cities around the world, is the sort of thing that we need to deal with. And the consequences are already apparent in rising sea levels, retreating glaciers, economically damaging weather events, flooding, droughts, storms, and the like. What are we going to do about this? In the absence of some significant global, you know, carbon tax, that doesn't seem to be any coming anytime soon. Perhaps the financial markets will play a role in order to keep us from scientifically estimated catastrophe. We need to keep global temperatures below 2 degrees Celsius over some long-term average, and a crude estimate, obviously, hopefully within an order of magnitude, being correct. We need about $12 trillion over the next couple decades to mitigate and adapt to this change. So how can capital markets play a role? There's a category of fixed income now called green bonds. Green bonds are bonds defined by their use of proceeds, which exclusively support some sort of environmentally sensitive purpose. This can be anything from biodiversity conservation to clean energy or safe water supplies and the like. I'll show you the categories of uses of proceeds for green bonds in a minute. So this is a growing market with many markers of maturity. There are indexes, ETFs, actively managed green bond funds these days. I'll tell you a little bit about the history of the market in a moment. There are many categories of issuers in this paper, and obviously relevant to this conference, why we submitted it. There's a lot to say, and the best data are in the U.S. Involved the municipal bond market. But issuers of green bonds also include supranationals, some corporations around the world, universities, and country governments. And from an academic perspective, this has some advantages relative to the stock market in terms of being able to say something about prices. How are these bonds priced relative to ordinary bonds? In the stock market, the level of prices is a very difficult thing to measure. We can estimate average returns over many, many years, and we still don't have a good sense of what true expected returns are. At least in the bond market, we have the yield at issue. Well, that's not a perfect measure of prices, but it's much, much better than what we have in the stock market. So if we're going to take a more academic view of just talking about what is the impact of investor taste on prices of securities, this is a relatively good setting for looking at that. So there's a sort of fixed income market analog to the SIN stocks literature, ESG, SRI investing literature. So some quick history of the market. This market started only 10 years ago with the first labeled green bond being issued by some supranationals there. 2010, associated with Build America Bond Program, there is a kickstart to the U.S. green bond market with some federal subsidy bonds. The first labeled green bond, self-labeled green bond, self-declared, was issued by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in 2013. The first self-labeled U.S. corporate bond was Bank of America the same year. And there are increasingly recognized market conventions for what constitute a green bond, having to do with the use of proceeds and how the proceeds are managed to guarantee that they are used properly. A set of principles were developed and promulgated by investment bankers in 2014, and so on. Over the last few years, worldwide issuance of green bonds is still a small number in terms of the global fixed income market, but it's doubling every year approximately. So this paper has three parts. The first and majority of my minutes today, that is to say 4 minutes instead of 2 minutes for the other chunks, is going to be about the overview of an overview of the U.S. green bond market. Then we'll talk a little bit about how green bonds are priced relative to ordinary bonds. And then to what extent is ownership of green bonds concentrated relative to the ownership of ordinary bonds? That is to say, do some investors have a special preference for green bonds? And what we'll see, just to give you a preview of the results from Section 2 and 3 here, is that, yes, the overall story is that it appears to be the case that there's a subset of investors willing to pay a little premium to hold green bonds. And that shows up in the prices, that shows up in the patterns of ownership. So I think that's pretty intuitive. In terms of identifying green bonds, we use a Bloomberg green bond flag, pretty simple. We decided that they're doing something of institutional quality, which is at least as good as, we would do no better, for sure. And Bloomberg recognizes the problem as there are many shades of green. This market involves self-labeling. There is no worldwide accepted definition of what a green bond is. Terminology often varies. And the bottom line is that is this bond being used 100% for some designated set of environmentally sensitive purposes? So that is about as concrete a definition as the market has come up with at the moment, and we just decided to use Bloomberg's own definition. Our sample, we have a couple U.S. corporate bonds, green bonds to analyze, but it's just such a handful that the majority of the paper is about municipal green bonds, and they come in a couple different flavors. I'll just skip those and just mention that, okay, we're using Bloomberg's definition of U.S. Municipal green bonds. So there's a line through an important column there. Panel A is the municipal U.S. green bond market. You see various indicators of how it's growing. And panel B shows that there are only a handful of U.S. corporate green bonds. And basically, look at the second to last column and the last column. That compares the volume of issuance in each year of green bonds versus non-green bonds in our emergent sample with the requisite data to do various regressions. So you can see that even in 2016, the last year of our sample, only about 2% or so of all municipal issuance in merchant is a Bloomberg green bond. But it's rising. So what are these green bonds used for? Again, the second to last column shows the amount of proceeds for different uses and for green bonds versus ordinary bonds on the very last column. You see the numbers are small for green bonds and mostly zero for a lot of categories. It makes sense that airports cannot issue a green bond or parking lots or things like that, but more likely to see green bonds being issued to finance public power or mass transit or more energy efficient university buildings, schools, and the like, or clean water, some sort of sustainable clean water project is another important use of U.S. Municipal green bonds. What are the characteristics of green bonds? There's a lot of numbers on this table. I'll skip them. Green bonds are slightly larger than average at the CUSIP level, slightly longer maturity, more likely to be federally taxable. That's as a result of the early green bond programs in 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013 to some extent. They're more likely to be revenue bonds, and naturally they're associated with specific types of projects, so that makes some sense. They're much more likely to be new money bonds. And finally, a subset of green bonds in the last row of the top panel there, a subset of them are certified, in a sense, by a third party and then registered with the Climate Bond Institute. And about one out of every 15 of the municipal bonds in our sample has this extra stamp of approval in terms of having a big four accounting firm or some independent firm saying, yeah, this really is a green bond according to this and that definition. So giving some investors some extra confidence that they're investing in something, you know, that is what it claims to be. So in terms of the pricing of these bonds, I'll skip, a simple hypothesis is that, well, most of us don't care if a municipal bond is green or not. Some subset of investors cares extra. And so it may be the case that such bonds trade for a little premium. And that's what we see. So that's a natural hypothesis. And it's sort of the inverse of the sin stocks literature. Here the question is a special subset of securities that is in favor, do those go for a slight premium? And in the sin stocks literature, tobacco stocks and firearms and so on, is it the case that such stocks go for a bit of a discount because they're out of favor by some subset of investors and they therefore deliver higher returns instead of lower yields? So I'll skip those sorts of analogs and the basic yield statistics. Overall, in a broad sample, not controlling for anything, green bonds sell for a slight after-tax premium. The more interesting and compelling results are our regression results. So here there are four specifications. There's approximately 2,000 green bond CUSIPs in our sample relative to 600 odd thousand non-green or ordinary municipal CUSIPs in our sample. And so we have four specifications with various types of control variables down there indicated, and a green bond flag. And so, for example, in the first specification, the after-tax yield of the average green bond in the sample is, controlling for various factors, about 7 basis points per year lower than an ordinary bond. For the subset of green bonds that is externally certified, that number about triples because such bonds are both green and getting a flag for the top row and getting this CBI certified flag here. So it's the sum of those effects that are associated with the prices of certified green bonds. So that is in contrast to the sum of those two effects is equivalent to reducing the risk of an investment grade municipal bond by about 2 ratings notches. So that's what a 25 basis point pricing advantage amounts to. And so it doesn't really matter what sort of control variables you're using. Qualitatively, the associations are similar across specifications. In terms of ownership concentration, so if there is a slight premium for green bonds, it would make sense that, well, this has to be driven by something. And our ownership concentration results, which I'll skip in the interest of time, just show us that indeed green bonds are disproportionately held by a subset of investors. There's less uniform, you know, just holding these bonds in market weights, and a subset of investors, often with some sort of green or environmentally sensitive or Calvert or, you know, socially responsible investment association in the name. So those sorts of funds are disproportionately holding green bonds. So they're being held by the sorts of investors that one would expect. So just to sum up, I've given you the briefest of overviews of this developing, interesting market, increasingly important. Green bonds sell at a premium, and green bonds are more closely held or held in greater concentration than the average bond. Thanks.
Okay, our discussant for this paper is Tim Coffin, a true practitioner's practitioner. Senior Vice President, he's a consultant and relations manager and director of sustainability at Breckenridge Capital Advisors. In his role, Tim focuses on developing the firm's institutional relationships. In his time at the firm, Tim has helped lead the introduction of Breckenridge's environmental, social, and governance capabilities to clients. He's been with the firm since 2012 and has over 21 years of fixed income experience. Prior to Breckenridge, Tim was a vice president at Fidelity Investments, where he launched and managed the firm's municipal finance group within capital markets, where he managed the sale and marketing teams and served his last 3 years as the firm's president. Tim started his career in fixed income and institutional sales at DLJ and RBC Dane Rauscher. Tim serves on the governing board for Ridley College and is a member of the Municipal Fiscal Health Working Group for the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. Tim received a BA from Hobart College and currently holds a Series 65 license. And before we get to Tim, I heard a sentence, and if the press is in the room, take note. I believe I heard Jeff say, I've never heard the sentence before as it relates to the U.S. municipals, that the U.S. municipal bond market offers the best information. So if there's a headline to print, you can take that out of the conference here. Maybe Tim will discuss that further. All right, Tim.
Thanks, Peter.
Welcome.
Thank you. You want to do something here? Hi, everybody. I don't have slides, so we're going to get a blank screen, I think. And I wasn't the president of Fidelity. There was a little misprint. I'd still be here if I was, though. Right. If I was the president of Fidelity, I'd still be here. But thank you very much for including me. And so I'm going to try and give about 10 minutes of discussions from the practitioner's point of view. So I think it's important a little bit to just frame who I am and who I represent and what my practitioner's viewpoint comes from. So Breckenridge is a fixed income investment manager. We're an independent firm in Boston. We manage about $36 billion in assets, and about a little over $31 billion of that is in municipal bond portfolios. And just to put that in perspective, that means that we are actively buying around $400 million worth of bonds a week, up and down the curve in the municipal bond market. So we don't manage any bond funds, we don't manage any green bond funds, but we are a leader integrating sustainability, the materiality of environmental, social, and governance metrics into our credit research on both corporate credit and municipal credit. And so I do think I have good perspective on this because many times when we go in to talk to prospective clients and talk about how we integrate sustainability into our credit research, they say, is this a green bond product? And which I think is a great segue into trying to offer some feedback or perspective on the paper, and that is that there is indeed what I would call a green bond inquiry in the market right now. There is demand for green bonds. So I want to try and follow the same three chapters of Jeff, which is an overview of the green bond market kind of from our perspective and how that relates to it, which is very consistent with yours. Discuss a little bit the pricing of green bonds and maybe a few suggestions from that standpoint, and then also the ownership concentration. And I don't really have any strong conflict with any of the observations that you made. I think your hypotheses and your predictions were something that anecdotally everybody kind of recognized. I would just say that you know, it's interesting, there's a Credit Suisse does an environmental finance conference every year in New York, and I always get invited. And I think that's because everybody who's looking for capital market solutions to environmental issues that are out there can't help but come back to the U.S. municipal bond market. Because realistically, as we all know in the room, municipal bonds have been green since the beginning of time, right? We've been financing clean water and public transportation, efficient energy and factors like that all at the beginning. And so we've really already modeled out all of these financing solutions that will ultimately be employed, hopefully on a more scalable level, to address many of the capital projects that are going to be needed to address environmental issues and social issues and factors like that. So the paper does, I think the sample, as you pointed out, Jeff, is over 2,000 municipal credits and only, I think, 19 corporate credits. And so I'm going to speak mostly from the municipal standpoint as well. And also highlights that environmental utilities and power supply tend to be some of the bigger issuers, and that only, I got to look at my notes here. I'm sorry. A smaller percentage were actually 14% of the green bonds were GOs versus a little over 46% were actually enterprise revenue bonds. And I think that's an interesting thing that, and I'll just give you some kind of reflections on that. First of all, I think it's very easy for, not easy, but easier for public utilities and energy bonds to arrange green finance, because if you're ever creating energy efficiency, what you're doing is you're creating a savings, and therefore you're creating a receivable, and that bankers can therefore bond against that. And that's a model that's already been proven out. I think the interesting observation that only less than 15% of municipal bonds are GO bonds, general obligation bonds, or green bonds, speaks a great deal as to the challenges that green finance faces. And that is, you know, when a municipal credit analyst looks at municipal credit, one of the first questions they ask is, what are they using the money for? How essential is the public purpose? And I think when Marty Walsh, the mayor of Boston, comes out and says, we need to build a $10 billion seawall, okay, clearly that's going to be financed in the capital markets. They're not going to do that. You know, they're not going to have a bake sale to raise that money. But at the same time, he politically has to make the case of essentiality to his constituents, to voters and to legislators and factors like that. And so, you know, if you compare K-12 education, which is largely financed through the general obligation bond market because they don't have revenues, there's a case where society has said K-12 education is so vital to our future that we're willing to provide, you know, unlimited taxing power, our property taxes, to back this. And I think it's very important for green finance and environmental finance to start looking at this. So to take a step back, the bigger picture there is banking green bonds is not the problem. Funding is the problem. And I think any of the issuers in the room would probably tell you that, right? You have to go out, make the case for essentiality, figure out how you're going to pay, what you need to build, how you're going to pay for it, and the bankers are waiting right outside the door, as are the investors, right? It is an open inquiry. So that's just kind of the overview from the practitioner, from the Tim Coffin world. Switching on to pricing, and I think pricing is really the conversation that there's a lot of back and forth on, right? So borrowers, they want, if they're going to spend extra time or money ring-fencing their proceeds or labeling their bonds as green bonds, they want to be able to demonstrate that it's actually providing them some sort of financial benefit, right? They just can't make that they can't make that expense without rationalizing it. Now, when Massachusetts issued the first municipal green bond, if Colin were still in the room, he's not in the room? Didn't stay for mine. There he is. I'm sorry, Colin. I take that back. Thanks, Colin. Here's to BondLink. When Colin first issued mass green bonds, there were three or four series of under one general obligation bond indenture, if I'm not mistaken, and yet the green bond had more orders. It was more oversubscribed than the original series. So that right there, there wasn't a pricing difference, but there was a liquidity difference, and so there was a benefit to the issuer. And I think when I run into issuers asking this question, they're saying, you know, why should we do this? Why is this necessary? All right. On the other side of that, you have underwriters and investors who have a fiduciary responsibility, not the underwriters, but investors who may be on a board or have a fiduciary responsibility where they really can't pay extra, all right? So maybe the Sierra Club can pay extra, using them as an example. But even there, you have investors who want to be able to say that we are kind of achieving our impact and aligning our investments with our mission in a way that is not sacrificing financial returns. So the paper talks about investors who are willing to do that, and I think that's a pretty small subset, and I don't think it's a scalable solution. And so the question really becomes, are green bonds worth more to mainstream investors? And I think pricing is going to be the ultimate, you know, I think you have to keep working on pricing. And I think what's great about this paper is that it does try to normalize and control all the pricing figures they look at, especially looking at after-tax yield for consistency. What I think I would have liked to see, and I think what investors would like to see, is a little bit more kind of relative value discussion. So when, as opposed to kind of absolute yields. So when investors are pricing bonds, they're more often looking at them in relationship to other bonds. So you've probably heard over and over again reference to the MMD scale or the AAA scale. And for those of you who haven't heard that, municipals are often quoted at spreads over natural AAA credits, like a AAA state GO, the same way corporate credits are quoted at spreads over treasuries. And this is the municipal investor's solution to identifying relative value. So I think what would be interesting in this paper would be to start looking at some of those absolute yields you've compared and doing it based on relative to the AAA scale. Because when an investor looks at CalGO, California GOs, and says those are trading 25 through AAAs, that may be perfectly normal for California, but it's not necessarily normal for Texas or Wisconsin. And so there more of that relative value observation from a pricing standpoint. Another ratio that that I think would help normalize over time would be that municipal investors will also look at tax-free yields as a percentage of treasuries. So you'll often hear that, you know, five-year munis are yielding 85% of treasury yields. And that's just a way of taking a kind of a better picture of the overall relative value of the tax-exempt market versus benchmark markets like U.S. treasuries. And so right now, where you have, you know, a very steep muni curve and you have short muni yields at a ratio of probably 60%, Steve, on the very short end of the curve, muni investors are saying from a relative value standpoint, the short end of the muni market looks very expensive. And so if you can try and work those types of ratios into your kind of pricing discussion, I think it becomes more useful for investors and for borrowers because they're looking at the same thing. Their bankers are coming in and saying, hey, short munis are really cheap right now to borrow, very expensive to invest in. And so I think that helps investors kind of make the case to invest in these bonds, and I think it will help issuers make the case for actually issuing these bonds. And I would I had another point to make about that, and I've lost my train of thought. But, you know, I think you do make reference to new issues. I think new issues are clearly a benchmark, and I would continue to do that. New issues and how bond markets clear makes a big or how new issues clear into the market is obviously a really important. Whether or not they're ending up in the street, whether or not they're, you know, how much of the bonds are sold. And I think some of that data can be gleaned from EMMA and things like that in terms of you can actually see the trading data for the first few weeks after investing. Ultimately, I think from an underwriter standpoint, I don't think an underwriter will ever be comfortable pricing green bonds at a higher price, lower yield than conventional bonds, almost from a regulatory standpoint, right? I mean, I almost think they could be challenged from that standpoint. But if they start seeing those bonds trade in the market at a premium, all right, then all of a sudden they can rationalize it. So if they bring a bond, let's say they bring a Texas bond, a green bond, at the same price as a Wisconsin green bond, and all things being equal, they go away at the same price. But in the secondary market, the green bond, the Texas green bond, is now out trading the Wisconsin bond. The yields are lower. That all of a sudden is giving firepower to the underwriter to say, I want to price the bonds. I have a reason why I'm allowed to price these bonds at a lower yield. So quickly, ownership concentration. To me, as I started out this conversation, this is just an inquiry. And so I can't help but think in the muni market that a green bond inquiry is no different than a state-specific inquiry, right? So if Franklin has a Connecticut bond fund, they're going to have greater demand for Connecticut bonds than a general market investor. And so to a certain degree, if there's enough wealth and enough taxes in Connecticut, there's going to be a premium charge for green bonds. So if Zurich Re or somebody comes out and says that they're going to dedicate $10 billion to invest specifically in green bonds, you know Wall Street's going to generate some green bonds. They're going to fill that inquiry. And so that, I think it actually makes very natural sense. And I think your search of actually going through and looking for names like Calvert and Catholic and things like that made great sense. It would be really interesting to see if any tax-free green bonds ended up in portfolios of tax-sheltered money. So did they end up in Norwegian pension funds and things like that? I think that would be an interesting point. Lastly, my concluding big statement is that I think one of the great benefits of this is what I think we're seeing here from an ownership concentration standpoint is investors increasingly are paying attention to how their money is used, how their investments are used. And what's very positive about this is this sense of stewardship of investing and stewardship of the capital markets. And if investors are increasingly showing demand for bonds that have constructive use in the municipal market, how might that actually translate into the equity markets or other corporate bond markets? And will investors all of a sudden say, you know, this money, these people are only raising equity so that a VC can flip a deal. I don't want as much for that because the proceeds are not as constructive. And I think what that's doing is, I think what's positive about the green bond movement and the socially responsible investment movement as it moves closer and closer to the mainstream is that it's increasingly asking investors to pay attention to what they own. And we, as a sustainable investor, would make the case that that's very, very material to long-term investment performance as well. So thank you.
Show of hands.
How many people have worked on a green bond deal in here? Anyone? Okay. Worked on, owned, bought. Okay. It exists. All right. Questions? Same as before. Stay away from.
Yeah. Absolutely. Sorry. That's right. Absolutely.
Thank you so much for your nuanced and detailed and informed discussion. And particularly, I thought the regulatory and legal tensions comments were really interesting that we hadn't fully thought through. We had a call with the, was it the deputy treasurer of Massachusetts? We won't name her. But and we talked about, you know, what was the history of your work with green bonds and why did you issue them, and as I recall, she said basically, well, this was just a refunding bond. We decided to just label it a green bond. So, and we didn't notice any pricing benefit, but it was the issue was easier to place. And so the economists among us, which was all four of us, we didn't really understand that statement. If it's easier to place, then you can place more of it at a given price. So there is, in a sense, a pricing advantage. But she didn't perceive it. It seemed to be pretty small. And that's consistent with our results, I think. In the scheme of the variability of yields at issue of municipal bonds, a couple basis points pricing advantage is lost in the noise for a given issuer. And even within a week, she informed me, you see, it, depending on has Dallas made a similar issue this week, then that's going to affect the pricing that I get in Massachusetts on a similar bond. So those sorts of uncontrollable random effects on the prices of individual bonds may be why you really have to look through hundreds of thousands of bonds and compare the big sample with many careful control variables, as many as we could put together, to identify a sort of robust but modest pricing advantage. So I thought some of the ways of benchmarking the pricing that we do versus how practitioners might more properly think about it, that's something we can explore further in the paper. Lost in the short discussion was how various fixed effects and interactions and time and issuer interactions help us pinpoint green bond pricing effects off yield curves at a given point in time. But I won't get into that. Definitely some interesting and useful takeaways from that discussion. And looking at aftermarket pricing, if we had better and more detailed data on aftermarket pricing, we would dive into that. And perhaps there is enough data at this point for us to at least take it.
That's the problem.
Yeah, that was our sense. So. But if we can get maybe for a subset of the bonds, say something at least, that would be interesting. But thank you again.
My pleasure.
Great. So we're a little tight on time. Lightning round. Steve.
Steve Winterstein, Women's Trust. Tim, I guess this is for you. I'm involved with the Municipal Impact Coalition, which is developing efforts to have a global scale ratings scoring system for ESG and green. And in my discussions, the whole sense of social return on investment, SROI, has been a repeated theme. And ultimately, I think these so-called green bonds need to demonstrate a social return on investment. And I know you and your firm do a lot of work on that. Are you seeing that enter the conversation as much as nominal spreads, the whole concept of a social return on investment?
Thanks, Steve. So the question is really about reporting. So if we tell investors that sustainability is material to their investment, how do we report on that impact? And so maybe you've heard of the Sustainable Development Goals from the UN, and a lot of investors are now asking for that. I think that any effort to standardize kind of reporting of impact, whether it's environmental impact or social impact, will be really well received. And I don't think it necessarily should be, you know, the impact of Breckenridge is not is really a collective on the intentionality of our approach for investing. We don't make a decision about something like reducing carbon intensity based on the values of that. We do it based on the materiality from an investment standpoint. So we're only going to report on our strategy. Whereas I think investors are increasingly asking for impact, and I think it would be better to standardize that. I know that, am I allowed to bring up other academics who aren't in the room? Bob Eccles wrote a report recently kind of trying to link SASB's materiality factors to the Sustainable Development Goals. I mean, if somebody can kind of unwind that or write that formula, I think it would be pretty valuable.
Yes.
Adele Morris, Policy Director for Climate and Energy Economics here at Brookings. When you think about impact, I think it's important to say relative to what. Certainly, clean water, there's already, you know, federal regulation for sewage treatment and water quality. Some of the clean power projects are mandated by state-level renewable portfolio standards. So some of this activity is clearly not additional to what is currently mandated by policy. So the impact is it, yes, sure, it's creating an environmental benefit, but it's not additional to what would have happened had those bonds not been issued because they were required to be issued.
I'll say a little bit. So that's an excellent question. And among the co-authors, there was a discussion of whether to title this paper Financing Climate Change Solutions or Financing the Response to Climate Change. And I was the one with the fingers on the keyboard most recently. And so we went with the slightly weaker framing, but that may change. If we come up with an idea of how really to identify whether these bonds are just relabeled bonds that would have been issued anyway, or whether there is actually new projects being financed. And it's a difficult question because we don't have the counterfactual, what would have been paid for in the absence of this market. I don't think it's making green projects less likely if there are some pricing advantages to these bonds, but in the current version of the paper and in the near-term versions, we don't have a great idea of how to distinguish between, is this just a labeling phenomenon or is there actual new projects being undertaken as a result of the development of this market? And so if anyone has any ideas, we'd love to hear them offline or online.
I would just say that as fixed income investors, we're risk mitigators, so we look at all of like sustainability from a risk mitigation standpoint, and so I would actually kind of refer to this as financing resiliency. We want communities that are demonstrating that they're investing in their resiliency, whether it's from a social standpoint or an environmental standpoint. If it's a coastal community, what are they doing about sea level rise? If it's if it's someplace in Arizona, what are they doing about drought vulnerability and factors like that? Because those have credit implications. Financing right. Resiliency.
That will be the last word. Thank you. Thanks, Jeff. Yeah,
Boston.
New York.
How are you?
Hands in Boston.
Yeah, yeah. We cross Boston. Yeah. If you're ever in Boston.
Okay, so we're now into the third item in our triple threat panel here. Financing dies in darkness, the impact of newspaper closures on public finance. Very interesting paper. And Dermot Murphy is going to be presenting the results of this paper. He's an assistant professor of finance at the University of Illinois at Chicago, who specializes in public finance, fixed income, and high-frequency trading. Two of his recent studies have been accepted for publication at the Review of Financial Studies and the Journal of Financial Economics. One of his current research projects examines the effect of local newspaper closures on public borrowing costs and has been covered by Forbes, Bloomberg, The Guardian, The Atlantic, and NPR. He earned a PhD in finance from Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern. Go Northwestern, my dad went there. An MSc in finance from the University of British Columbia, and a joint undergraduate degree in business and math from Memorial University of Newfoundland. Welcome.
All right, so thanks for having me here today. So yeah, that's the title of the paper, Financing Dies in Darkness, The Impact of Newspaper Closures on Public Finance. Financing Dies in Darkness, of course, that's a bit of a play on the Washington Post byline. So let me talk about the state of the local newspaper, first of all. So they have essentially been in decline since about the early 2000s. So according to Pew, here in D.C., circulation numbers have been down about 27% from 2003 to 2014. And that represents a decline of about 15 million subscribers. Now, importantly, during this same period, the number of full-time statehouse reporters was down about 35%. So this is very important for our purposes because that means that governments are not being watched as closely. So there's an FCC report in 2011 that stated the following: in many communities, we now face a shortage of local professional accountability reporting, and this is likely to lead to more government waste, more local corruption, less effective schools, and other serious community problems. And I couldn't resist putting up an example of an article from my current home state of Illinois. Part of the motivation for the paper came from an excellent segment by John Oliver on his show Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. He was covering the state of local journalism back in 2016. And he said that local journalism is very important and that television stations and online news sources, they frequently rely on research that is done by local reporters. He says that those places, internet sources especially, often just repackage the work of newspapers. And he says, watch how often TV news ends up citing print sources. And he even refers to his very own segment that says that all the research they did comes from local newspapers. And he finishes by saying, not having reporters at governor's meetings is like a teacher leaving her room of seventh graders to supervise themselves. David Simon, who's well known, and he was a former Baltimore Sun reporter, in 2009, he was talking about the future of journalism in Senate hearings. He stated that you do not in my city run into bloggers or so-called citizen journalists at City Hall or in the courthouse hallways or at the bars where police officers gather. And he also said that the next 10 or 20 years in this country are going to be a halcyon era for state and local political corruption. It's going to be one of the great times to be a corrupt politician. I really envy them. So big problems, and I'll get to our perspective shortly. Because we're finance professors, so we'll be looking at these problems from a finance perspective. But we can see that newspaper closures, they're well distributed over time. So we collected newspaper closure information from the editor and publisher yearbooks, and we saw that, okay, since 1996 to 2015, there have been plenty of newspaper closures. So they're not concentrated in the recession or anything like that, so we do have a good distribution here. Furthermore, we have a good distribution of newspaper closures geographically, so they're not concentrated in a geographically or an economically depressed area. Like they're not concentrated in the Rust Belt, for example. So this is a graph of newspaper closures from 96 to 2000, but you can see that the newspaper closures definitely spread over time. Going up to 2015, we do have a pretty good distribution, or pretty bad distribution, you could say, of newspaper closures throughout the country. Why do newspapers close? I think we pretty much know the reason for this. One of the reasons is that there's been a decline in readership because the internet mostly has become a viable alternative for gathering your news, especially among young people, of course. But there's also been a significant erosion of advertising revenue from search engines, for example, and from Craigslist. There was a study that showed that Craigslist cost the newspaper industry about $5 billion from about 2000 to 2007. So they're not the sole cause of newspaper closures, of course, but they were one of the contributors. And according to Pew again, you can see that there has been an uptrend over time of where people mainly get their news, and nowadays it's mostly from the television and internet. And this is as late as 2013. I'm wondering if the internet has since overtaken television. And here's an interesting closure example. So I think that Denver is a very interesting area right now for studying newspaper closures. So the Rocky Mountain News was a fairly substantial newspaper in the Denver area that had a circulation base of about 250,000 subscribers. And they closed in 2009 due to declining circulation numbers and advertising revenues. And we looked into the Rocky Mountain News, and they did cover, they did provide valuable coverage of local governments. Issues such as a potentially illegal deal between the city and Lufthansa Airlines. And they discussed a lack of oversight of the so-called special taxing districts in the Denver area, among many other issues. So here's our main question, okay? How do local newspaper closures affect public finance outcomes in the long run? So our proposed channel is this. We believe that when a newspaper closes, there is a loss of a local government watchdog. And if there's no more government watchdog, then that means that governments are more likely to engage in bad behavior. If I, as a lender, want to lend to a local government, I might have to ask for a higher interest rate to compensate for lending to a riskier government that may be deemed or seen as more corrupt. So to conduct this study, we do collect data from the editor and publisher yearbooks to identify the newspaper closures. And then we cross-reference this information from the Mergent Municipal Securities Database. So we have information about offering yield spreads, essentially, from 1999 to 2015. So we're going to be looking at how yield spreads react to newspaper closures. And we'll get into establishing causality a little after that. So here are the baseline results. I just put it in bar graph form. I didn't want to have too many numbers on the slide. So we looked at both all bonds and revenue bonds. So this is the result from a multivariate regression. And the pre-closure period is the blue bar. And that basically looks at counties which are going to experience a newspaper closure but haven't yet versus counties that will not or have not experienced a newspaper closure. And there's no difference before the fact between the counties that are going to experience a closure and ones that did not. So there's no difference beforehand. But after the newspaper closure, that's where we see the big effect. Okay? After the newspaper closure, we see that bonds in the closure counties are about 5 basis points higher than the matched counties that did not experience a newspaper closure. And we find that this result is even stronger for the revenue bonds. So revenue bonds, of course, are backed by cash flows generated by specific projects. And it was our hypothesis that these are cash flows that are more likely to be misappropriated. So there's going to be more of an effect here. So they're more corruption prone, you could say. And this is where we see a much bigger effect. We see that there is about a 10 basis point effect of a newspaper closure on borrowing costs for revenue bonds compared to revenue bonds in counties that did not experience a closure. 10 basis points is high in the fixed income world. We calculate that as about 25% of the risk premium on a risky bond versus a bond that is not risky. So that is pretty substantial. And so what's hidden in this graph, of course, is that we control for many things. We control for state year fixed effects to make sure that we're looking within state and year, and that also helps to control for statewide recessions and actually countrywide recessions. We also control for time to maturity, whether the bond is general obligation, the size of the bond, whether the bond is insured, and so on. Lately, we just did an adjustment for the call feature on the offering yield so that we just looked at the straight bond component and we just removed the call option feature and our results still hold. In dollar terms, we find, using a back-of-the-envelope calculation, that this newspaper closure effect leads to an additional $650,000 in interest on the average loan in present value terms. And we consider this a lower bound estimate, in fact, because a municipality does need to take out many loans over time because they're constantly funding different projects. And we also consider this a lower bound estimate because if the newspaper closure problem or the coverage problem continues to worsen, then we could see interest rates getting even higher, especially if we manage to extend the sample period. You know, we wait another 10 years and so we see how things look. The effect is especially pronounced in low newspaper counties. These are the counties that didn't have many newspapers in the first place. So we compare the effect in low newspaper counties to high newspaper counties, and we see that the effect is primarily felt in the low newspaper counties. So what I'm saying is that places that are kind of news deserts in the first place, if they lose like their only source of news, then things get much worse. So it's the news deserts where things are especially felt. We have a nearest neighbor test to help further establish causation. So we look at a county that experienced the newspaper closure, and we look at one of the county's neighbors in the same state that is matched on economic and population characteristics. We think that the counties that are neighboring each other are more likely to be correlated economically, and they do have similar characteristics because of our matching procedure. And we do find that the county that experienced the newspaper closure does have a significant increase in their yields, as opposed to the county that did not experience a newspaper closure that's neighboring, the yields stay mostly the same. One more causality test is our two-stage Craigslist test. So we found this Craigslist instrument useful for our purposes because Craigslist was slowly rolled out to different counties over time. So we examined the effect of Craigslist on the probability of a newspaper closure. And we think it's unlikely that the entry of Craigslist is going to lead to increased yields. So what we see is that when Craigslist enters an area, we find that the probability of a newspaper closure goes up by about 10%. Again, we're not necessarily saying that Craigslist was solely responsible for the decline of journalism, but this is, again, a useful instrument because it was slowly rolled out over time. So it was one of many negative shocks to journalism. So the probability increases by 10%, and the knock-on effect on yields in the second stage regression is about 4 basis points. So this helps us establish causality again, that there is actually an effect of the newspaper closure on public finance outcomes. We have some additional tests that help to drive the point home. So we look at closure effects by state type. So one of the first state types that we look at is the differential effect by political isolation. So Campanti and Doe have shown that there are states that are more politically isolated because their economic center is far away from their political center. So one example, again, is Illinois, Chicago versus Springfield. And so what they show in their paper is that corruption is more likely in the high political isolation states. And so we decided to look and see if there's a differential effect on the high political isolation states versus the low ones. And we do find a significant effect. Although newspaper closures do have an effect in both types of states, the effect is much bigger in the high isolation states, essentially, where there's more likely to be more corruption in the first place. The second state type regression we do is we look at the differential effect by internet usage. So we identify states that have high internet usage versus low using information from the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. And so we think, well, if online sources are providing a really good substitute, then you should see that there isn't much of an effect in the states that use the internet more. But we're not really seeing a differential effect here. We're seeing that there is a slightly stronger effect in the low internet usage states than the high internet usage states. But we're not seeing any statistically significant difference. So, you know, our takeaway from this regression and our overall study, actually, is that we don't think that internet sources are necessarily providing a perfect substitute for the information provided by the local newspapers that were in the area. The last part of our paper, we examine government inefficiencies after a newspaper closure, and we do see evidence of increased government inefficiencies as well. So we look at negotiated sales, for example. which are typically associated with higher yields, and we see that the likelihoods of negotiated sales are higher after a newspaper closure, along with advancer fundings, also more likely, and research has shown that advancer fundings are costly, that they're usually negative NPV propositions. And we look at some other government inefficiency metrics, and we do find that government wages as a percentage of all county wages increase. Governments are paying themselves more. More government employees compared to the employees in the county, and higher taxes per capita for residents of that county of about $85 per person. So our conclusion is that public borrowing costs increase and government inefficiencies become more pronounced following a newspaper closure. And our main takeaway is that local newspapers do play an important watchdog role for local governments that is not easily substitutable by other sources. So one possible policy implication is maybe there should be more state funding for local journalism initiatives. And I'll end with this quote from David Simon again. The day I run into a Huffington Post reporter at a Baltimore zoning board hearing is the day that I will be confident that we've actually reached some sort of equilibrium. But I don't know what equilibrium we are at yet, but we shall see. So, thank you.
All right. Last but certainly not least, Leslie McGranahan is a Vice President and Director of Regional Research in the Economic Research Department of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. She will be the discussant for this paper. Her primary research interests relate to the effect of federal, state, and local government policy on individuals and households. She has written about numerous government programs, including the Earned Income Tax Credit and Child Tax Credit, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, and the Sales Tax. She also closely follows regional and national developments in government spending and tax revenues. McGranahan's research has been published in journals including the National Tax Journal and the Journal of Political Economy. Her work has also been featured in the Chicago Fed Letter and Economic Perspectives, the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago's publications. McGranahan returned to the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago in 2004 after working as a lecturer at the University of Warwick and as a research economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies in London. She's received a bachelor's degree in politics from Princeton and master's and doctoral degrees in economics from Northwestern.
Great.
So, this paper has been really, really eye-opening, actually. It's been kind of neat to sort of follow, look at newspapers and look at the newspapers you see and see what they cover and who covers them. And so I wanted to start and to say, like, the main conjecture in this paper is actually really well-documented. First of all, that newspapers think of this as their role. So I looked really quickly, because we're both from Chicago, what does the Chicago mission statement of the Tribune say? It says, the Chicago Tribune is a citizen of Chicago, a newspaper committed to inform and lead public opinion, to foster commerce and industry, and to furnish that vital check upon government which no constitution can. So the Tribune, in its mission statement, the commerce and industry thing is interesting because it was founded by Cyrus McCormick, so there's sort of this industry path, but also that it thinks of itself as serving this watchdog role on government. And if you actually look at some of the statements from people in the government, they also think of the newspapers as being, as watching them. So there was something, someone asked about something going on at the Denver Post, and when the reporter was going away, the response was, if there's no reporter, somebody from the government said, hey, that means we can do whatever we want. And so I hadn't really thought about this. I don't know if you had seen that quote as well. But like this notion that the newspaper thinks it's their job and that the government thinks that's what the newspaper is doing in part. So the paper finds that sort of two things happen once the newspaper closes. First, public finance spending increases. So the wage bill goes up, the public employees increase, and tax revenue go up. The paper sort of views this as inefficiency. My take on these particular things is that it's less government efficiency and more something like government size. So the size of the government is increasing. And this seems to match, in my mind, like something like a Brennan and Buchanan Leviathan model of government, so that, you know, nobody's watching, and so that the public employees or the leaders who have a sort of taste for a larger government sort of get their way without the watchdog role of the newspaper. So I was kind of a little bit challenged by the notion of inefficiency. The other inefficiencies, or sort of the notion that things change in the bond market, are a little bit more outside of my area of expertise. So the notion that more of the change in the bond market may be something that seems more like an inefficiency to people more broadly. I thought these measures of government seem more to be saying something about government size. So the sort of public finance spending increases and municipal borrowing costs increase by 5 to 11 basis points. So the yields go up. And I think when you look at the abstract of this paper, the first response is that there's going to be some sort of omitted variable bias, right? That there's something that's causing the newspaper to close, it's causing stress in these jurisdictions as well. And I was sort of thinking like sort of you have something like a Janesville story that the GE plant closes, the city can't, the city residents can no longer support their paper, and they also can't issue a bond. And sort of that's sort of the first worry you have when you read what they're doing in this paper is that there's some sort of omitted variable bias. And I think there are sort of three things that made me, by the time I sort of read through this, come away with not worrying about that nearly as much as, and not really worrying about that at all by the end. First is that map, where you see that the location of the closures don't necessarily seem to correspond to what we think of as places that had unusual levels of stress. It's not focused all along the Rust Belt. The second is the timing of the newspaper closures, which don't really seem to follow the economic cycle in a real sense. And finally is this Craigslist instrument. And the Craigslist instrument is like on page 20 of the paper, and I think it should be like on page 3. Because the Craigslist instrument is really what makes a reader believe the underlying mechanism is actually working in the way it's stated. It's a really amazing instrument, in part because the bias seems likely to run the other direction, in the sense that if you think of where Craigslist was most likely to open, it's more likely to be in the places that were doing relatively well. And so insofar as they it would have caused a newspaper to close, it was sort of leaning against the wind because Craigslist is more likely to go into thriving areas, I would think. So that's sort of the main conjecture being well documented. Yeah, I think we don't have a ton of time, and my slides are pretty short too. So the other questions that I had after I felt like this the main mechanism was the main results was well documented, and wanted to push a little bit more on what the mechanism is that is causing these changes. And really, I think the main point is just the sentence here is that. Is this really about something that's happening in the bond market and the structure of the issuance of debt? Is it something that's happening relative to the creditworthiness of the borrower, the borrower is getting more risky? Or is it something about the information set of the people who are lending to the municipalities, in particular because so many of these bonds are bought locally. So as the local residents are getting less information, maybe less positive information as well as negative information about their government, they need to be compensated more. And I would like the paper to spend a little bit more time really teasing out which of these mechanisms corresponds to the set of facts. And one of the ways I thought the paper could do more of that is really by tracing out over time what happens to different bonds. So like for example, if there's a bond that's already out there and has been issued and then the newspaper closes, what happens to that bond as opposed to new issues and as opposed to future issues? So I'd like to see the things traced out more over time. The other thing is just, is there something going on about different levels of government? So while the county newspaper is the unit of analysis, the newspaper closure, the issuance are all across the different types of issuers. And so there could be changes in coverage based on the type of issue. In particular, I think like school districts, no matter what, get a ton of coverage, but they may lack thoughtful analysis, but they may be getting more coverage, for instance, in something like a special district. And okay, just just the last thing is maybe a little bit something encouraging, sort of at the end, is may we be seeing the pendulum swinging in the other direction? Are there signs that the equilibrium is going towards maybe the Huffington Post person being at the bond hearing? And I think that one of the things I was excited to see in your graph is that something that more people are listening to the radio, and this seems to be a somewhat of a golden age of public radio, and maybe there's some sense in that public radio is picking up the slack. We had a meeting recently with our local public radio station, and they're doing great. Now, maybe this is a very anecdotal thing, and maybe people are more informed about what's going on within public radio, but my sense is maybe they're picking up some of the slack, and their reporters are doing some things. And the other thing is the hyper-local news. I know that in our community, there's a ton of coverage of obituaries and sports by, 14 different little publications. And I was wondering whether there's some sense that some of these smaller sort of hyper-local sources that have the ability through the internet to get to a very localized population are helping some of this underlying problem. But I'll leave it at that so we can ask good questions.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, great. Dermot, any thoughts in response or reflections on those comments? Yes, okay.
Well, first of all, thanks for the great discussion. You mentioned that government inefficiencies, it might just be a proxy for increased size. I think I agree with that statement, and it also depends, too, on whether you think a bigger government might actually be a more inefficient government. I'm not sure. As for Craigslist, you said it should work in the other direction. To push back on my own paper, I know that somebody mentioned before that, well, Craigslist might be entering counties where people are more receptive to buying secondhand goods. So maybe that's why you would see that correlation. So I don't want to push on that too much because I mostly disagree. But I just thought I'd mention that. You mentioned something about the different levels of government. We do have sector level information, so we haven't looked at it yet, but we would like to see if the effect is strongest for a certain type of sector, such as education. That's an excellent idea. You skipped past the slide that said sports on it. We're currently doing a text analysis right now of newspaper articles that have had things like local government, fiscal, mayor, and so on that appear in it. But we also use as a control the word football. So we're comparing football to fiscal issues right now, which ties right into your comment. And I think that's all I have. That's good.
Great. Handful of questions? Yes.
Hi, it's a really interesting, Tracy Gordon, Urban Institute. It's a really interesting paper. I just want to amplify some of Leslie's comments. I'm still concerned about the mechanism. So the idea that lenders are somehow seeing these places as more risky, I just have this feeling that, the bond market vigilantes are not going to save us. Lenders don't care, right? Lenders care about getting paid. And I think that the fact that you're finding a strong effect for revenue bonds rather than GO bonds, if reputation was the primary mechanism, then that doesn't seem right, if there's a secured source of payment for the bond. So I'm more inclined to think that riskier projects are going forward, and so I think Leslie's idea about looking at outstanding bonds versus new issuances is a really great idea. When the newspapers close down, if the people who are in charge are no longer evaluating projects as carefully, then you should see an effect for the new issuances, but not necessarily the bonds that were issued before the newspapers closed down. In terms of Craigslist as an instrument, it sounds so cool, and I sort of wish I believed it. But I'm sympathetic to the causality thing, because when you're talking about something, what I'm going to propose is sort of a time shift shift in preferences, right? A time varying unobservable that you can't really address. So I used to live in San Francisco when Craigslist came around. The receptivity to Craigslist as a substitute two local newspapers, I think says a lot about the population, the degree to which they're engaged in local politics. So I remember it was the time at which sort of the green candidates for the city council were sort of a big deal. And I was talking with someone about the Senate pro tem, John Burton, who was sort of a lion of the California Senate, and mentioned something that he was doing. And this person said, I only follow the liberal politicians, right? So to my estimation, that was sort of a sign that she was just checked out of local politics. So the degree to which people accept Craigslist or the Huffington Post as a substitute for these local papers, I think, says a lot about underlying preferences. So if you could somehow sort of get at this project quality issue, I think that that would help explain what's going on here a lot more.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. We'll look into that. So I think that we can see the differential effect on bonds that have lower credit quality. You mentioned about secondary market yields. I didn't mention that in the presentation, but we do also look at secondary yield data from the MSRB EMMA database. And we find that there's an effect there as well, actually. We were motivated to look at revenue bonds in the first place because, we did see anecdotal evidence that cash flows from these types of projects could be misappropriated from a stadium, for example. So we thought, we could possibly see a differential effect a larger effect on these bonds if our mechanism holds. So we're hoping that that helps support our story and convinces people.
I would just think that when the issuance goes forward, that the offering statement could cover things like accountability and the ability to redirect revenues, right?
Yeah, I would imagine so. I'm thinking that this is more based on soft information. So, you don't only rely on the prospectus, for example. And so whatever you think you know about the local government or what you don't know could factor into the pricing.
Okay, I see we're at 10:15 and maybe a minute or two after. Thanks to all the panelists. Thanks to all of you. I think we give us all a big round of applause here.